turn your back on the baby.
You can check it out on ESPN.com. He made a funny today saying more people wrote his, read his column on Donald Sterling and Donald Sterling's racism written 9 years ago. More people read it yesterday than read it when he wrote it 9 years ago. And this has been a little bit exasperating, I would say, to me and Bomani, because we're always yelling about racism in other places. And now everyone else is yelling about it, and we're kind of laughing about it. So let's start here, Bomani. What's the funny in this?
Dude, this man can't keep his lady friends under control. We are in this situation because this man's wife resented the fact that he had spent all this money on this particular woman. You decide why this would be the one to make her jump over the ledge on it. And so she sued this woman for $1.8 million. This woman doesn't have $1.8 million. So how is she going to get from under this? By threatening Donald Sterling. Donald Sterling didn't think she meant business. Then she brought the haymaker with this. And you listen to the call and you're just like, wait a minute. You would rather your woman sleep with Magic Johnson than take a picture with him?
That was amazing. That has gone undercovered. This part of the story has been undercovered, that Donald Sterling is so crazy at this point in his life that he's like, don't take any pictures with Magic Johnson, but you could go ahead and sleep with him.
As much as you want.
What is that?
Yo, I'm just telling you, we all got our decisions that we make and the things that we rock with, but I don't think there's anything improper about saying if I have a suspicion that you're sleeping with Magic, I need some answers, and I need some answers now, and if you are, that's fine, but you're not going to be sleeping with me.
What just happened here, Bomani?
Why'd y'all do that to me right there? Why'd y'all do that to me? Y'all went real silent at that moment, knowing damn well everybody's on the same program
you
here.
Felt
I
that?
Don't think there's nothing wrong with that.
Wait, you expected me to go silent?
No, you know
that,
you nailed the landing there. You nailed the landing like a gymnast.
Yeah, but y'all did. Y'all still kind of left me out there like, ooh, I think you might have gone too far.
I mean, he's right. We didn't exactly, like, cradle him like Bella Carolla.
I was trying to move the conversation to some of the others.
Okay, just checking. Just making sure everybody is in the right place.
What else is funny about this?
Let's see, what else? Well, just the way he talked in that telephone conversation, he was so meandering, and this silly, silly woman, I would change my skin color if I had to. And she looked at him and said she took down all the pictures with black people. She thought Magic didn't count because he was Magic. And then she says, well, Matt Kemp, because Matt Kemp is mixed like me. I met his mom. What?
Why is no one else seeing the funny in this, Bomani? Like, why?
Because this is the only opportunity that a lot of people out here will have where they feel comfortable within their souls and within their psyches to stand against racism. Because it's so easy to do it on this right here, and it's so scandalous. Like, you talk about this, the whiff of scandal. It's such a funny story when it comes to it right there. So everybody's like, I can't miss my chance to speak down on racism, because when the next time comes and it's real racism and me and you are actually talking about it and the rest of them are being silent, that's when you get to pop up and be like, but wait, I said something about Donald Sterling.
Dan, am I allowed to laugh at any of this?
Less so.
Okay,
what would stop you from being able to laugh at this whole idea with Magic? I think we all can laugh at that.
I mean, that's crazy. That is the talk of a crazy person. Like, I don't even understand what the seeds of that are.
Well, here's what's going on here, and this is what I don't think people are discussing. He didn't say he didn't want black people coming to his games. He didn't say he didn't want Magic Johnson coming to his games with black people. He said he didn't want his woman out there with black people because that was going to be embarrassing to him. And most of the racism that he talked about on that call was actually blaming racism on society and saying that he was simply riding along with what was necessary given the world that he was in. Now, you tell me right now, if you believe for a second that Donald Sterling is the only person that'll see his woman out here comporting with a bunch of young black dudes or black dudes of any type, tell me right now you think he's the only one that would have a problem. He's not. Right? Like, what he talked about was actually fairly illuminating if you want to listen to it, because what he said was, this is how things go with the rich people I hang out with, and the rich people I hang out with don't want their woman out here hanging out with black people, even if she's black.
Bomani, did any of this make you angry? Anything?
No. Why? Like, I mean, the things that Sterling did, I don't want to make this too personal, but this is a very important thing to me. I had a very good friend of mine die on Friday night going into Saturday in Chicago. Her name is Lynn O'Draper. She had planned an anti-violence rally, and she attended that rally that she helped organize on Friday and died that night on her block. And we have no idea who shot her. We probably will never know who wound up shooting her. We hear all this stuff that goes on in Chicago and all these people who die, who lose their lives. On one hand, we lose the humanity because there's so many people that we don't think to personalize them. I just gave it a person. She and I were close enough that she put me in her husband's wedding party because of the level of close we are. These are people I've seen. I watched her grow into a person that would organize a rally like the one after which she died, right? All that stuff that's happening in Chicago is a byproduct of housing discrimination. I was talking to somebody today who would tell you there are large swaths of land in Chicago in between, like, the south suburbs and downtown, just on the south side, that people simply don't live in. Because in Chicago, when black people moved to that city from the south in the 1940s and 1950s, white people got the hell out of Dodge. They built a freeway system that ran through black neighborhoods, and the whole purpose of that freeway system was to get white people from the suburbs into their jobs safely without having to make any stops in between. That's what housing discrimination does. Housing discrimination is the biggest reason that we could point to historically for why we got all these dead kids in Chicago fighting for turf, fighting for real estate with poor accommodations and facilities and everything that you're supposed to have within the city, poor education, all of this, because the tax dollars and everything else decided to move away. And a lot of people like to use it as a strategy to avoid that. It's like to find an apartment in one of those nice neighborhoods so then they can send their kids to nicer schools and have a chance for their kids to go somewhere in life. Instead, when you can't do that, you wind up in basically where, like, these neighborhoods that are created by apartheid, and they're desolate, and they're dangerous, and they're frightening, and we just have whole generations of people that we have given up on. And the biggest reason that this sort of thing has happened is because jackwagons like Donald Sterling make this decision that they do not want black people or Mexicans or anybody else living near these pristine white people who are trying like hell to get away from us, and then point at us and wonder why all your stuff is messed up. That's the stuff that Donald Sterling has been doing forever. Everybody talks about that settlement in 2009. He was originally sued in 2003 for this housing discrimination. In 2006, we got a hold of the paperwork where he says that black people smell and attract vermin and that Mexicans just sit around and drink all day. His wife was going around to those properties, knocking on the door like it's some Henry Ford stuff and taking inspection, posing as though she worked for the government while she was tracking the ethnicities of the people who lived in their buildings. And you're going to come to me and talk about what's going on with Donald Sterling and his mistress? Are you kidding me? That stuff was real. That stuff matters. That stuff literally kills people. And everybody and their mom is so charged up about Donald Sterling. So I'm going to go to a funeral next week for somebody who took somebody else's bullet, because that city's become a war zone, and the people that have money and the people who could possibly do something to fix it ignore it and go to their homes in the south suburbs that for the last 70 years people have tried their damnedest to keep black people out of. But I'm supposed to get charged up because Donald Sterling said his rich friends don't want his black mistress to be around black people. People need to get their heads out their clavings and realize that this here is fun to talk about, but this is nothing. The real stuff that happened was that. So when all these guys get up here and stand on their soapbox and wag their fingers and start talking about, oh, we won't tolerate this racism, we won't tolerate what Donald Sterling said, what they're not tolerating about Donald Sterling is the fact that what he said was impolite and what he said was gauche. That's what their problem is. But when Donald Sterling was out here toying with people's lives on things that really matter as matters of life and death, the media, the NBA, the sponsors, and all these people now who want to get patted on the back for what good people they are didn't say a mumbling word. They can all kiss my behind, every single one of them, because when we start looking at all these people in these lists who are dying as the economic byproduct of the people like Donald Sterling, and you now have a problem because, oh, my God, he said something that intimated that he doesn't respect his players, I'm calling you out as a fraud.
It cannot be said better than that anywhere. It is also dispiriting. Like, it is. There's an element of it that's just totally dispiriting, Bomani, because this is going to be the news cycle and the noise cycle for the next, however long this lasts. And what you just said right there can't creep its way into the news cycle.
Well, we got to find a way, though, because the thing that people need to stop doing is people need to stop lying about their levels of concern about race. Look, I can live with the people every day who tell me I talk about race all the time and tell me I scream racism all the time, because they never say anything about when racism screams at me. When racism screams at me, I'm supposed to shut up and take it like a soldier, right? And if that's what you want, hey, I've gotten pretty far in life. Maybe that's the technique you think that I'm supposed to have, right? Maybe that's what it is. But when the real stuff happens, nobody has anything to be, nothing to say. And if you were to ask people, what exactly did Donald Sterling say that intimated his own level of racism? A whole lot of people are going to have a hard time saying it. But then you go ask those people how many things they do so that they don't look like they like black people around their friends. What you think these people who get up on the internet and tell me stuff like, I normally don't agree with you, comma, but, dot, 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 you don't think that's what they're doing? What they're doing is saying, hey, this guy has a good point, but I don't want you to think for a second I'm out here agreeing with his crazy rabble-rouser, right? That's what people are doing out here all the time. They talk about this with the NBA, and they keep calling this a black league. This is an American league. So that's why you wind up with a columnist at the LA Times who said that if Donald Sterling has a problem with black people, he should go own a hockey team. What? Because it's supposed to be okay in hockey? So if you own a team over there, you can be racist and nobody cares about it? No. A whole lot of these people that want to act like they care about racism don't give a good damn about racism. What they care about right now is a chance to jump on an easy punching bag. But when I sit up here and Dan sits up here and other people sit up here and tell you about real things that are happening and try to break it down and make you explain to you and make you understand the things that you might not be able to recognize on your own, that someone with a more trained eye to these things could possibly help you with, you act like I'm inventing stuff. Well, now, 8 years after I wrote a column, even my editors, when I wrote it, admitted that they didn't give it enough play when they put it up there. 8 years after I wrote that, now everybody wants to come around and hail me as having some amazing level of foresight for seeing this coming. I didn't see this coming. I saw this happen. So where the hell was everybody else when it was actually happening? They were out here trying to tell me that I was crazy about racism, but now you know it. Because Donald Sterling's mistress put out a tape and an 81-year-old man said, you're embarrassing me by coming to games with black people.
I got to go get Stugatz out of the parking lot. Thank you, sir.
No problem, man.
Okay. Does that sound familiar to you? Does that tone sound familiar to you? It should. It absolutely should. That, by the way, was Carlos Santana taking us into the intro to the program with Black Magic Woman. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead. It is Thursday, May the 1st, and ESPN's Bomani Jones got us started and gets us focused on our discussion today. I contended from day one of this whole debacle, this whole imbroglio, that it is in fact just a sideshow being made to look like the main attraction. And so everybody's kind of in it and not in it at the same time. Because this revamped version gives us a quickly defined problem. It quickly assigns blame. It gives us an instant hero as a counterpoint to the villain, the hero being the NBA commissioner, the villain being Donald Sterling. It gives us resolute action. He made his decision, boom, it came down with like a hammer, and it's done. Resolute action, solutions. It gives us a warm and fuzzy feeling about justice being done, about the right thing being done, and most importantly, it does all of this very quickly so as to return us to the good old status quo. And in the meantime, these black players, whether they are aware of it or not, that was my point, they are in fact part, an essential part of the charade. They are playing a designated role in this drama, in this continuing saga that we call racism in America. And where are they coming down? They're coming down on all of the non-essentials. They're not tackling racism. They're reacting to the fact that, A, just as Bomani said, you had a tawdry tape, and it was, you know, a prurient interest in the private conversations between two people in which strange views were expressed. And on the basis of that, and it is yet to be tested in a court of law whether that could even be, these sanctions are even legitimate or can actually be done. On the basis of that, these folks are all over the place. You had the players being used to indict their employer, which is bizarre. You have players pronouncing, the guilt, quote unquote, of Sterling, and siding with the NBA commissioner, shoring up his decision. All these bizarre things, and nothing speaking to the structural problem of racism within the NBA. And as I said before, when the time came for these people to stand up and address racism, they headed for the hills. And that was when Elgin Baylor, who was a former manager, who had sued Sterling on the basis of race and called attention to the institutionalization of race and racism within the NBA. Nobody stood with him. We did not have the NAACP leaping forward to get involved so that Elgin Baylor could get justice. We didn't have the Players Association saying anything or saying, look, man, we can't take care of your entire legal bill, but here's $100. We didn't see them respond to racism, structural racism, that in fact impeded their progress and was commensurate with their supposed power as accounting for up as much as 75% to 80% of the NBA. We don't see them moving as if they understood and still do understand that power. No, they were colluding with the power structure. They were absent from the fight. And now we have this scandal, which is really what it is, a little tawdry thing going on, and they're fully involved. As if nobody has said to them, this is precisely the time for you to shut up. This is not your fight. This is a problem for the NBA to solve. That's their job. This is a problem for the NBA owners to solve. Let us see what they produce as an institutional response, if they so choose, to racism. And not on the basis of this call, but on the basis of a documented history. Bomani Jones was writing about this 9 years ago, before Commissioner Silver, there was a previous commissioner, David Stern. What did he do? How did the NBA as an institution deal with racism within the NBA? So you see, this is what I mean. Don't get flustered and get sidetracked. Keep your eyes fixed on what is a problem and what isn't a problem. These folks are not discussing racism. They're discussing the embarrassment of an owner and, by proxy, the embarrassment of the NBA. And the very victims of racism are participating to expunge the institution against legitimate charges, but not in this respect, not in this context, but to confront the NBA on the structural racism that existed and still does exist. When Baylor filed his suit, for example, he had his salary frozen at $350,000 a year up until the time he left. When he sued in 2009, he called attention to the structural problem of racism within the organization, which was a clear indication that that was an organizational or structural or institutional problem. That is when the players should have said, we need to intervene here. That's when all these NAACP types, you know, the buzzards that circle the carcasses, looking for a chance to get their nibble of the cadaver, of the carcass. They didn't come forward. No, the NAACP, for the measly few dollars that Sterling gave them over a couple of years, gave him a lifetime achievement award. And this is a standard pattern. I caught hell from the NAACP and the Urban League and whatnot when I was the editor of a newspaper, the City Sun, and we had a phenomenal editorial cartoonist who came to us from the Smithsonian, and I asked him to do a cartoon, and the cartoons that he did were so powerful. I even used to run them on the front pages because you don't even need an article. You don't need any written words when you have a very powerful rendering. And he drew this cartoon. It was like a street fair, a county fair type of thing. There were tents, and under each little booth, you had a very voluptuous person, and there were kissing booths. And the sign says, you know, kissing booths. And there was a long line with faces that you recognized, including Ed Koch at the time and Mario Cuomo and others. But each of the booths had a name. One was the NAACP, the other one was the Urban League, and so forth. And this long line of people with a lot of money, you know, bags of money, waiting online for their turn at the kissing booth so that they can, for a kiss from these institutions, they will hand over all their money, like Coors and all the other corporations that had been so offensive to the African-American community. My God. The people loved it. The governor himself called and he was upset about it. And of course, that meant it was very effective. But it was meant to draw attention to the habit of these organizations and individuals, high-profile African-American individuals, whose essential job is to absolve these miscreants from their racist practices, to give them a way out of accountability. The NAACP has been doing that for years. The Urban League has been doing that for years. We now have Al Sharpton doing that for years. Jesse Jackson, they've made a whole career out of this. They've set up the Madison Avenue Initiative and the Wall Street Initiative, and for the right price, as I said in an editorial, Jesse Jackson will come to your town and completely undermine your revolution. That's the problem. That's what's going on now. So that the very people who are going to be and will be the actual or potential victims of racism are now taking on the burden of expunging the institution of racism. These people are not thinking. Either they have a vested interest in behaving this way, or they just plain don't know any better. So let's be clear. All of the hubbub is not about racism within the NBA. It is now isolated. This guy is over the line, and he is a singular and unique problem. And the players are agreeing with it. Yes, we got to take care of him. And once we take care of him, we can now get on with the business. Again, they don't see beyond it. And they're now actively involved in completely undermining an exquisite moment to address a structural or institutional problem. It is not in their interest to tackle this question at a different level. Simplify everything. It's all done. We saw the problem. We've taken care of it. We know who the bad guy is. We've lowered the boom. Life can now go on. And yeah, the only thing is we have this matter of having him sell the, we have to make him sell the Clippers, in which case, you know, the buzz is now which blacks are going to line up to say, okay, I could get a team. Is it going to be Oprah? Is it going to be Magic? As if that deals with the issue. And do you believe if Oprah Winfrey or Magic Johnson or whoever African-American buys a team that that necessarily changes things, changes the structure? Has anybody discussed within all of this the absolute duty and obligation to make Elgin Baylor whole, to compensate him for the fact that his salary was frozen at $350,000. The guy behind him, the very next guy, the white guy they hired right behind him, got a $22 million contract. $350,000 a year versus $22 million over 4 years. And nobody is discussing this as a necessary part to fix this problem, which is to make this man whole. That's justice. And now we will talk, see what these people, the owners, produce and their advisors. Let them spend millions of dollars, get advisors about what should the structural response be as an institution to this question of racism. What are the rules? So I'm going to pause here for a minute. And I'll let you chime in at 888-874-4888. And we come back right after this little musical break.
Got your spell on me, baby. Got your spell on me, baby. Yes, you got your spell on me, baby. Turning my heart into stone. I need you so bad.
You're listening to PRN.FM. This is Lead Stories. I'm Utrice Lead, and your calls and comments at 888-874-4888. We just listened to an extended discussion that just nails it. Bomani Jones writing for ESPN.com and having a nice little visit in which she is chatting on ESPN with Dan Le Batard's Miami-based sports show. And to my mind, he did a masterful job. Nobody expected him to go there. I know when he started talking about the hilarity of the situation, the last thing people expected was for him to make that link. And what a link it is. When he talked about if Sterling is accountable, the structural problem was the NBA should have moved when he was found guilty, when he had to settle on housing racism, housing restrictions, that and link that to how it impacts on the fact that he now has to attend a funeral of a friend who basically was a victim of these kinds of structural thinkings, these kinds of structural moves. That's really a fantastic correlation that he made there. From Connecticut, George, you're on the air. Hello? George, are you there? Okay, we can't hear you. From Philadelphia, Claire, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. Good to talk with you again.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to respond to some of the ideas that you've expressed. I want to thank you for yesterday. That was very enlightening. You took on an aspect of it that I hadn't even considered. I hadn't had a chance to think about it because I hadn't heard that much about it. But today, I want to respond to your criticism of the players in particular. I think they're a reflection of our culture, not only the black culture, but the culture at large. Thinking is not a part of our cultural tradition for the last 50 years. It's a matter of getting what you can get. And if you have what you need, it seems to be enough.
Amen.
It's as if capitalism at its worst has taken over the minds of the people. It's very unfortunate. I'm not surprised because, as you used the word, it's risky. It's too risky to step out and do the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't see it changing. I'm just so glad that you're on the air bringing these things to light. And some people will latch on to it and understand what you're talking about. And maybe begin to act differently. That man, Sterling, he's a feeble, sick, old man. I'm the same age as he is. I have very little money, but I feel very fortunate in comparison to that man. If people could begin to think in those terms, we'd be so much further along in our civilization.
Thank you very much, Clara, for your call today.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
George, you're back on the air.
Yeah, I hope you can hear me now.
Yes, I can hear you now.
I think if you read between the lines, they had a very good discussion in that tape you were playing back from the radio show. I think this is a bigger issue beyond the racism issue. It really gets to the point where these elitists basically see everybody as subgroups, you know, okay, we might be a better animal than that animal, but really, these people have basically destroyed entire communities. Now, we don't talk about, like, say, a Bridgeport, that's not too far away, it used to be a booming industrial town, completely black. Now everybody's unemployed, everybody is living in poverty. They all had decent jobs, decent homes. Look at the homes that were there when those things, beautiful homes. Everybody could make a decent living. We don't talk about the greater destruction that these elitists make. They make decisions to destroy their own communities around them because they have better profits to make elsewhere. You have one individual or a couple of individuals hurt with this, with their attitudes with this basketball, but Chicago, Detroit, the bankruptcy nonsense with Detroit is another example that you had a great guest on there, and I think that should be drummed up, and we should have a big program because they're going to do it throughout the entire country. This is racism, but it's beyond racism. These elitists feel that they're above us all. We're just cockroaches on this country for them.
Well, yes, and the point I was making is this: the players unwittingly are part of the unwillingness, if you will, of the institution to take on the responsibility to correct itself. And it's the people who are literally mostly the targets of racism, the African Americans, are going along with this thing that no, that thing should be, tell us what it is you what is your answer to structural racism. What are you doing? We're not the answer. We're looking to you. You are the institution. what is your commitment, and how are you going to rid this institution of this issue called racism? How are you going to deal with it? But instead, they have manipulated themselves into the equation, not even thinking that, in fact, they are being played. Thanks, well, George, for your call.
All right.
Thank you. From Dallas, Sarah, you're on the air.
Yes, Eutrice.
Hello.
Yes, Eutrice. The situation that you on today's topic that you're covering with the NAACP, and yes, we have to look at them as being the problem, as I've continuously stated. What this situation has exposed us is has shown us the elitism, not only with the players, but with these organizations that we think are representing us. And as you said with the cartoon that you were running in the City Sun that showed the kissing booth, and how all of them are lined up there with monies, and this is exactly what they do. These people are in the shakedown game. They look for opportunities that when they see there's something that would give them in the national spotlight and could potentially give them a windfall, that is the only time the NAACP steps up. They don't step up if they know something is going to be very long and litigious. They're not going to take it on because they don't see any benefit in it for them. Even though it could be for justice, they're not going to get involved with it. But if it's going to be short with a big fat payday, then yes, they're going to jump out in there, they're going to come in, they're going to take it over, and they're going to push you aside, and all of a sudden they want to claim a victory for themselves. They have done it continuously, because we only have to look to what they did with Shirley Sherrod. Here it is, this woman that was working for the FDA. Her father, who was lynched by the Klan in Albany, Georgia, this woman was working and helping people to get their property together, do whatever, even the white people. And they just rushed in and they just absolutely destroyed this woman. It took the same white people who she helped, who they were trying to paint her as being a reverse racist. These people had to come and say, no, it's not. This is not the truth. This woman helped us, and, you know, we have the proof of it. They had to run on CNN and everywhere else before the White House and Ben Jealous and all of them, they had to backtrack on that story to say, oh, we are sorry, but the damage was already done. It already ruined this woman.
Mm-hmm.
And they've continuously done situations like that where they always like to jump in and they don't do proper investigation. This man, this Leon person, Jenkins, who's running the chapter, if they would have checked his background from Michigan to the city, he was disbarred. He's disbarred in California. This man was taking bribes. But the elitism on them, they went and they put him as chapter president of an organization. Now, here it is. If you can't maintain your law degree, and if you have to do something really bad in order for the state to say, okay, we're going to disbar you, and you were disbarred in two states, and they don't want no part of you. He's tried to be reinstated twice, and they turned him down in California. They said, no, we're not going to reinstate you. But yet still, the NAACP say he is a good candidate for them to put as to be president of their chapter. It tells you that they need to, that chapter need to be closed. All of them need to be fired. Every member of the head of that board for that chapter, they all need to, their heads need to roll. Because this has put it on the forefront and for us to see that the NAACP is no good. They need to go. We need to shut them down. It's been time.
Okay. You know, to add to your comment, I make this note that in New York State, of course, the NAACP is very, very closely tied to the Democratic Party in New York State. And in New York State, we have a Democratic governor. But for more than 30 years, Alton Maddox has been barred. He's never been disbarred. There's no complaint against this man at all, anywhere. He's never been brought before the American Bar Association or any kind of judicial process that would cost him his license and his right to practice law. And for all these years, not one person has made the move to say to the governor, listen, we are not going to have this screamingly illegal move continue on this attorney who has a long history of defending people in the community for free. And we demand that whatever the impediment is that was illegally put there, and it was put there by a state attorney general flagrantly violating the law, the state legislator, is the only instance in the history of the United States where a state legislature decided that it will bar an attorney from the practice of law in the state and beyond even the state. Nowhere else is there a history like that. And for all these years, this has been allowed to stand, and we say we have an NAACP and the Urban League and Al Sharpton. By the way, Al Sharpton would be probably still in jail by now had Alton Maddox not defended him on 67 federal counts. And this is what I'm saying, the anomaly about what people have in mind when they talk about power and institutional power. A complete waste of time. Thanks so much, Sarah, for your call. From New York City, we have Joel.
Hi, Lee. Hi, Trace. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thank you, Joel. And you?
A very, very effective program. I thought I would very quickly give you two or three very short anecdotal narratives about Elgin Baylor and about the NBA that shed light on what you're talking about today, if that's all right with you.
Sure. Please do.
The first one is a little autobiographical. From 1961 to 65, I was between the ages of 17 and 21. I was a member of SNCC and did a lot of voter registration in Mississippi. And in 1962, Elgin Baylor came down and spoke to us in the summer of 62. And Baylor, I'm not sure how much you know about the NBA, but Baylor was a terrific ball player, a Hall of Fame player. And he spoke about how difficult it was, because at that time there was a quota system of blacks in the NBA, playing in the NBA. And I remember that. And then I remember an event in 1966 when the NBA All-Star Game was being televised nationally for the first time, but the players didn't have a union. And Baylor led a movement of players who were playing in that game, telling the ownership that unless they were allowed to form a union, they wouldn't play the game. So it showed a lot of courage there. And the final point I want to make is that about 10 or 15 years ago, when the Chicago Bulls were winning all those championships, when Michael Jordan and Scottie Pippen were the leaders on that team, you might recall, they had a player by the name of Craig Hodges, who was a guard, an outside shooter, a deadly, deadly outside shooter, who was a terrific player on that team because he had a lot of open shots because everybody was busy guarding Pippen and Jordan. And Craig Hodges was something of a black nationalist, trying to get a lot of the players on his team to read Stokely and Charles Hamilton's book on black power. And next year he was gone.
Wow.
So, I mean, I think that everything that you're saying reflects the basic paradigm that race, class, and plutocracy are all connected. And as far as I'm concerned, all of these people are absolute hypocrites. And I just want to say one last thing. And that was when I was in SNCC, it was still a civil rights organization, a radical civil rights organization under the aegis of Jim Foreman, who was just before Stokely took over. We always talked about the difference between residual racism, symbolic racism, and the real nitty-gritty stuff, which was all about economic power, political power, and social acceptance. And we knew that there were far deeper issues than the question of one's the exposure of you know, of the bigotry of one plutocrat.
Absolutely. Could you, for just a quick minute, could you tell us what the differences are, residual racism, symbolic racism, et cetera?
Well, I mean, you know, as you remember, SNCC, you know, was a pretty radical organization then, and we even had our differences with the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, even though we cooperated with them for 4 or 5 years and worked with them. And we even felt that the Public Accommodations Act, as important as that was because after all, I mean, the idea of being able to drink coffee or drink tea with white people is fine, but you need to have the money to be able to buy that tea and buy that coffee. Far deeper are issues that are associated to prejudice in education, in employment, in real estate. I think, you know, with regard to the Sterling business, and here we have a guy who made his money in real estate who was violating civil rights laws again and again, and no one ever even talked about that. So that's the difference. The difference is the structural, institutional questions of economic and political power, as opposed to things that are important but don't really turn on questions of economic and political power. You know, like people calling you a name, which is horrible, but is not quite the same thing as being denied employment or housing.
So what, therefore, how should the institution of the NBA right now approach this question of racism?
Well, the first thing they ought to do is try to be honest, show that they have some kind of intellectual integrity, and say the things that you're saying, that for 3 years, or even more, for many years, they've known that this guy was an inveterate racist, and they did nothing. So they need to say, ask themselves, why did we do nothing? What is it about the structure of our organization which seems to allow for this kind of awful situation to persist? So I think the first thing that they would need is intellectual integrity. Then there's something else that I think that's required, and that is that I think there needs to be a re-education of many of these ballplayers, 70% of whom are African-American, and the great majority of them come from inner-city neighborhoods and have been exposed to enormous amounts of wealth very rapidly and very quickly. And I think they need to see that if the players themselves need to see that if they feel very strongly about this issue, they have to look at this issue realistically and say to themselves, how come there are so few black people in the stands? Why are there so few black people watching these games in the stands? Why in a city like Detroit is the stadium where the players, the arena where the players, play their games outside of it? Why is it in Auburn Hills, a white suburb, and not in Detroit? You know, things like that, showing an identification and a connection to the larger society. Instead, what we see is a lot of players who get their rocks off attacking some obnoxio plutocrat who issues racist statements, but the real issues of economic power and social power are not really addressed. And they also get off rationalize this by engaging in forms of charity, which the teams and the league support. And we all know that charity is the back end of social change. It's not the front end. The front end must come from the government through its people. So there are all these ways in which they are circumventing the reality of social inequality. And I think that these kinds of discussions need to be established again. But I just wanted to bring up some of these other things that went on that I never talked about.
Thank you so much for your contribution today. Very profound. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Well, you see, we know we have an innate sense that what we are actually witnessing is just, as I said, the charade, a sideshow. The main attraction is where the hard work is, and where what Joel just described, people literally have to roll up their sleeves and wrestle with these problems. But if you are more interested in money, and if you are basically interested in maintaining the status quo, that is very, very important. It is about maintaining the status quo because so much went into devising a structure that will not yield very easily to change. It's like the Catholic Church. You know, you crack up every now and then when you hear some priest talking about it's time to change the rules. Yeah, sure. Hundreds of years have gone into meticulously constructing an impregnable wall, and you think you're going to be able in 15 minutes to take, you know, to tackle bringing down that wall. It's not going to work. And so there is a need to structurally engage with this level of racism, and it means that the players have to up the ante. They have to up their own game intellectually and in a professional sense to guard their interests. Not for themselves, but they're not thinking down the road either. They're not thinking way ahead that how is it going to be what is it going to be like for a ball player 10 years from now or 20 years from now? This is what they needed to do back in the 90s and in the 80s. I could understand you have to start somewhere and it will take time, but they certainly have enough resources among themselves to begin to articulate their own imprimatur on how they're going to deal as professionals in a hugely profitable sector. They certainly have the muscle. They certainly need to up the ante in the way they interrelate with all these owners and whatnot. They are part of this capital structure. So they can't just be pawns in this game, and they can't just be on the sidelines. They have to be in it, but they don't have to basically form some protective barrier around an institution that clearly is at fault here for not taking care of business and for maintaining a status quo that is to the disadvantage even of the players themselves. So they've got to take care of that. And the public should be really clear that this scandal associated with it, that's not the issue at all. Yes, it's tawdry and it provides nice juicy headlines and people want more of the salacious stuff and that's fine. Go right ahead and deal with that if people are at that level. But don't get confused. That is not the story. It's not the story at all. Our eyes should be set for the decades to come and to use this moment. It's an opportune moment to really begin the process of flexing the muscle. That's what we have to do. So I want to thank you very much for your extraordinary contributions today. I thought, again, I want to congratulate Bomani Jones for a masterful job of bringing this thing into focus in such an incredible way. He did a great job, as he did 9 years ago, when he was trying to tell people, this is why this man ought to be investigated. This is why the NBA needs to consider this person and his continued membership in the organization. When he is doing these kinds of things that in turn contribute to harm of the community. So this is fantastic work. So thank you all. Coming up next, Occupied Territory America with Mike Fader. You want to keep it here? Drop me a note. Let me know what you're thinking. LeadStories@gmail.com or on Facebook, Lead Stories with Hugh Treece Lead. Thank you. It's a pleasure, really, and a privilege. I mean that, to be in your company. Thank you so much.